It's May 30th. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. For those of you tuning in for the first time, our friends at the American Humanist Association define humanism as a rational philosophy informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion.
So, Jess, what do we have on our show this month?
Well, this month we have an interview with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist E.O. Wilson, and also the winner of the Humanist Album of the Year, folk singer Dar Williams. Mm-hmm.
And she won that award at the New Humanism Conference, sponsored by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University. And that conference, the New Humanism Conference, occurred in Cambridge, Massachusetts in April.
Right.
Jess and I were there interviewing lots of people, and that's where we recorded these interviews you're going to hear today.
Yep. And also?
Well, we left our listeners sort of hanging on the edge of their seat last month, I believe.
Yes, we did.
Novelist Salman Rushdie was speaking with us, and he asked a question for our humanist advice columnist, Maureen Matsumara, known as Sweet Reason. I love how he refers to her as an agony aunt. I guess that's like the British term for an advice column. So why don't we replay Salman Rushdie's question again for our listeners, and then we'll play Maureen's response.
Salman Rushdie, I have one final question for you. I know you have to go. Humanist Network News publishes what we think is the only advice column for humanists, questions about life as a humanist. And I'm wondering if you have a question for our Sweet Reason humanist advice columnist. Any issues that you might want to ask about?
You mean that kind of agony aunt?
Yes, an agony aunt.
Well, I think one of the problems that I've felt is the lack of a language in which to speak about these things, because religious language is so highly developed and has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years to establish itself. And non-religious language sometimes feels impoverished. But the question is, where do we go to develop that language? You know, that how do we get the right words? You know, for instance, if you're a person who doesn't believe in an afterlife, a word like the soul would seem to have no meaning, you know? And yet, many of us, whether or not we believe in paradise or a god or an immortal side to ourselves, understand what we mean by the soul. So the question is how to create a language that works. Ask your agony aunt that.
Well, we did ask, and here's what Sweet Reason had to say.
Trust Salman Rushdie to ask a question like that. I think you've articulated something that bothers a lot of people, but I'm going to have to disagree with you. It's hard to see the direction of a historical change when you're living through it, but we're in the middle of one that has been going on for hundreds of years. Non-religious language has grown richer, and it's still evolving. And with the spread of literacy and modern communications, the change can only go faster. Terms that used to be religious now have entirely different meanings. If I say fast food heaven, you don't think of angels and halos. You think of fish and chips. If I call someone a saint, you're not going to think I mean they've been canonized by the Catholic Church. You'll know I simply mean a really good person. June Calwood, the famous Canadian social activist, was nicknamed Saint June, and she was an atheist. Slang has taken the process so far that in the days before pop-top cans, Americans called beer can openers church keys. Ecstasy used to mean mystic contemplation of the divine. Now it's the name of a drug. I'm talking about the English language because it's the only language I speak fluently, but I'm sure listeners can think of equivalent examples in other languages. At the same time this has been going on, the religious monopoly on the language of morality and inspiration has been broken. Artists and philosophers, along with ordinary people, are actively reclaiming the language of values. For example, in his poem Howl, Allen Ginsberg makes it clear that we decide what's holy. Holy, 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 he chants for 15 repetitions, and then tells us what he thinks is holy. Everything, every person, the entire world, and each part of the human body, hand, skin, nose. Writers create phrases and images so powerful we forget where they came from. Just the other day I commented, "All's well that ends well," without stopping to think that Shakespeare had said that first. The way we use ordinary words is also powerful. Instead of worshiping saints, we can admire heroes who use their courage to serve their fellow humans. Instead of sanctimonious charity, we have free-flowing generosity. Instead of the immaterial soul, we have the sturdy human heart. Love and loyalty, family and neighbor are heartwarming words. I'm not saying that finding value here in our natural world always works for the best. Patriotism and some ideologies have been taken to horrific extremes. But that happens on a human scale, correctable by human action, without waiting for miracles. Mystery no longer means forbidden knowledge, but problems to be solved, and asking questions is a noble act. What we have come to understand about the world around us opens new realms of meaning, and images are given to us that are truly universal. Photos of the earth seen from outer space inspire awe, and we can replace the idea that we are all God's children, which only starts squabbles about which God we mean, with the knowledge that we all inhabit one planetary home. The very words global and planetary are now richly symbolic, and if we want to place them in a larger context, we can speak of cosmos rather than creation. We're all in the process of discovering, creating, using, and sharing a language of human meaning and value. All we have to do is keep at it.
Hi, this is Melanie from the band Circe. You're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. So, Duncan, you discovered that this question has been on Salman Rushdie's mind for quite some time, right?
Well, it has. I was speaking with Matt Cherry, who's the executive director here at the Institute for Humanist Studies. And Matt was talking to me about how Salman Rushdie has referred to the God-shaped hole that's been left by his loss of faith, and how he's tried to fill that hole with the art of the novel. This is like a pretty well-known quote that or soundbite that Salman Rushdie has used before. But here's the new update. Matt has been reading Rushdie's latest novel, Shalimar the Clown, because he's getting ready to take a long airplane flight. He's looking for a good book. And he came across this passage from Shalimar the Clown. "The sky is sad and beautiful, like a great what? Some sort of altar. The sun has drowned in its own congealing blood. Your memory shines in me like, damn it, ostensoir. Oh, right, a monstrance. Again with the religious imagery. New images urgently needed to be made, images for a godless world, until the language of irreligion caught up with the holy stuff, until there was sufficient poetry, an iconography of godlessness. These sainted echoes would retain their problematic power even over her." So, I mean, that's the dilemma that, that's a character in Shalimar the Clown going through this, but it's what Salman Rushdie has been speaking about. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about Sweet Reason's response?
I think that she hit it on the nose. Like, uh-huh. Let's not recreate, you know, a language, but let's reclaim the language that's already out there.
Something that has occurred in other movements, right? Like
that's
the
right.
Gay rights movement?
Right, the gay rights movement, but the civil rights as far as race goes, right?
Right, okay.
It makes sense because we're always saying that we need to learn from these bigger movements who have been more successful. And more, you know, well-known, I guess, uh-huh. in the general public than us.
What do all you H&N podcast listeners feel about this topic?
You can let us know by calling our listener comment line at 206-339-4168. And we would love some comments for Sweet Reason's response to Salman's question. Mm-hmm. Or if you would
like
to
disagree with Malin Matsumara, Sweet Reason, on this topic.
Yeah. Do we need to create our own language?
Uh-huh.
You can also ask Sweet Reason any other question for a future version of Audio Sweet Reason. Uh-huh. And you can also read Malin's column in our newsletter, Humanist Network News E-Zine, at humanistnetworknews.org.
Jess, can you give that listener comment line one more time?
I sure can. 206-339-4168.
Okay, Jess, these are some descriptions that I found while Googling the name of our next guest. Darwin's natural heir, our contemporary Thoreau, one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century.
Wow, those are some pretty big shoes to fill.
What happens when you Google your name, Jess?
Something very similar to that appears. Thank you very much.
Well, you got to be careful. If you keep Googling yourself, you're going to go blind.
That's not how the joke goes.
No, sorry. Those are descriptions of our next guest, Harvard University biology professor emeritus Edward O. Wilson. E.O. Wilson is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for his nonfiction works on Human Nature, published in 1978, and The Ants, published in 1990. Wilson is known for his career as a scientist, for his advocacy for environmentalism, and for his scientific humanist ideas concerned with religious, moral, and ethical matters. He was born in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1929. Wilson became a leading authority on ants, and based on his study of ants, he found clues to human behavior. This led to his belief that there is a biological basis for the social behavior of all animals, including humans. However, it was controversial at the time, and he was attacked by fellow Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould for being a racist. Wilson is now a major voice in efforts to maintain the Earth's biodiversity. He described himself at the conference as an uncompromising secular humanist. He was also raised as a Southern Baptist, which figures into his current work reaching out to that community and asking Southern Baptists to join scientists in saving the planet. His newest book, The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth, is a passionate plea for science and religion to work together. I spoke with E.O. Wilson in person in April at Harvard University. Here's that interview.
E.O. Wilson, how long have you been using the term humanism to define your worldview?
Pretty much since the first time I ever heard the word used.
And when was that?
It would have to be, I guess, when I was a student myself many years ago. Because you do like to have some kind of a label. You don't want to say, oh, I don't believe. Because then the response is, you mean you don't believe in anything? Well, of course you do. Humanists are the children of the Enlightenment. They are the citizens, try to be global citizens who believe in applying factual information, particularly obtained by scientific method, to human life, to understanding the human condition, and to improving it. That's my nutshell description of a humanist, and therefore it's worthwhile to identify yourself as a humanist.
A lot of people attending this conference here at Harvard, sponsored by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, are representing various humanist organizations, volunteer or professional groups. What do you see a need for humanist organizations, and what role do you think they should be playing in society?
Oh, there's definitely a role. Up till now, the principal role, obviously, was to find a way to combat incursions of extremist religious ideas, or even less than extremist, into the official organs of public life and governance. And by changing laws in the favor of their particular set of beliefs, are trying to introduce into government at the bureaucratic level people who will commit themselves to furthering it. A lot of that has been happening, and that's just one area where active humanist groups can do a lot to identify, expose, and keep under control that pernicious influence.
There's been a lot of attention around Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and Daniel Dennett has been very outspoken about issues of God and science. Sam Harris, been in the news. These thinkers have been dubbed the new atheists, and they have a certain style in presenting the issues to the public. You have been working on coalition building with members of the religious community, and I'd like to know, do you see a value in the style of the new atheists? What role do you see them playing in this situation, and what role do you see humanists like yourself playing in this situation?
I call them the military wing of the humanist society of secularism. And yes, they play an important role because they are the vigilant ones. They're the guards, and they will come down on any unworthy, untoward incursion on the part of believers in particular religions into the public domain, that is to, in attempts to gain some control and governance. And they correctly point out the underbelly through history of religious groups. But they are militant. They are rightly perceived as the enemy by many people of more fundamental faith. And sometimes they go a little far. I find Richard Dawkins perhaps just a little too aggressive. And I don't agree with him about religion being a pathology. He thinks it's something to be cured, like a case of influenza, and that when we're all well, that is free of all religions, we'll be a healthy people and species and body politic. I think that's not right. I think that religion, or the tendency to form religions of one form or other, is hardwired as a high adaptive Darwinian value, and that you can't just get rid of it. You have to have it evolve, help it evolve into something more based on reason, fairness, and genuine universality based on common interest instead of just promotion of a single particular belief system.
The humanists and the new atheists, the militant wing of the atheists, the aggressive ones, we're all on the same side of the spectrum of belief. We differ in our tactics. You have received attacks for your work on the from the right and from the left, especially in the 1970s. What is your advice to humanists? About how does one criticize, let's say, our colleagues without alienating them and, you know, without appearing to have like a sectarian feud?
Well, that's just mostly a matter of style. For example, I've just given you an example of it. I can say I respect Richard Dawkins. I like him personally. I think that what he's doing does a lot of good and probably is necessary. But then I can criticize. I can say I too think that being as extreme as he is likely to repel people who might give serious consideration to humanism, who are somewhere in that zone of flexibility, and that I disagree with him on the authentic nature of religious belief in human history and prehistory. But beyond that, I would expect that he and I could sit down and be very friendly. You keep it that way. You use the nice convention, even if you're about to disagree strongly with someone, of saying, with all due respect, and preferably then you add a few things as to why you respect that person. Somehow, in these kinds of battles that have gone on between humanism and fundamentalist religious belief, we can't bring ourselves, or haven't been able to bring ourselves to say, with all due respect. Well, in promoting the new humanism as not an alternative but a complementary approach to the new atheism, I go out of my way to avoid conflict up front by saying at some length, with due respect, then asking for help. There is no way that's better than asking for help to get the friendship of a person. And I do like to think that while the military wing, our fellow humanists, will gain a few converts, particularly those that were very uncertain, I think I'm much more likely to get the ear of the faith community and actually persuade people to give, much many more people, to give serious consideration to what scientists are finding and what humanists, the new humanists, all the inclusive humanists, are trying to say.
The Irish singer Bono, from the band U2, is a very liberal Christian, but he has made great headway convincing some of the more fundamentalist Christians to support AIDS prevention. And he has done it by using the scripture and articulating that the victims of AIDS today are like the lepers in the Bible. So he's sort of, he's quoting scripture. And I'd like to know your thoughts on when humanists are reaching out to coalition build with the religious, is it useful? Should we speak in their terms? Should we use the scripture to illustrate some of our points?
No, it's not. I can do it, but you can't. I was raised a Southern Baptist. So when I quote Christian scripture, there's an authenticity to it. But when a person who's not raised on the conservative side of the religions does it, it sounds a great deal patronizing. So I would not. I would just express respect another way. But I do enjoy quoting scripture to underwrite, you know, the stewardship role commanded in the Old Testament, especially by God.
Final question. What can our listeners as humanists do to support you in your work building coalitions and to raise awareness for very important scientific issues and including environmental protection?
Hug a fundamentalist.
Ian Wilson, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
That was two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson speaking with HNN's Duncan Crary. And up next, we have folk singer Dar Williams, who received the Humanist Album of the Year Award at the New Humanism Conference presented by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard. We're going to start our Dar Williams segment with a live recording of The Christians and the Pagans. We're playing this recording courtesy of the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard and also with permission of Dar Williams.
Sipper up here for the holiday. Jane and I were having solstice. Now we need a place to stay. Poor Christ-loving uncle watched his wife hang Mary on a tree. He watched his son hang candy canes all made with red dye number 3. He told his niece, it's Christmas Eve. I know our life is not just that. She said, Christmas is like solstice, and we miss you, and it's been a while. Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground the best they were able. And just before the meal was served, hands were held and prayers were said, sending hope for peace on earth to all their gods and goddesses. The food was great, the tree plugged in, the meal had gone without a hitch, till Timmy turned to Amber and said, is it true that you're a witch? Mom jumped up and said, the pies are burning, and she hit the kitchen. It was Jane who spoke, she said, it's true, your cousin's not a Christian. But we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share, and we find magic from your God, and we find magic everywhere. I think magic's in the learning, 'cause now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning. When Amber tried to do the dishes, her aunt said, really, no, don't bother. Amber's uncle saw how Amber looked like Tim and like her father. He thought about his brother, how they hadn't spoken in a year. Thought he'd call him up and say, it's Christmas and your daughter's here. He thought of father's sons and brothers, saw his own son tuck his sleeves in. Can I be be a pagan. Dad said we'll discuss it when they leave. So the Christians and the pagans sit together at the table. American farming ground the best they were raised. Lighting trees in darkness, learning new ways from the open wilderness. Making sense of history and drawing warmth out of the cold.
That was a live performance of The Christians and the Pagans by Dar Williams at the New Humanism Conference this past April. Dar Williams has been making music since the early 90s, and she's known for writing about her own personal memories and growth, and also about the collective growth as a community or as humans in general. So she's both very political and very personal. And she says about her latest album, My Better Self, which is the album that she won the Humanist Album of the Year for, I'm thinking about where we are right now in history. So her songs are laced with humanist values, which you'll hear her talk about in our interview. But her writing style has a more subtle humanism, sort of an undertone. She often talks about personal growth metaphorically as flowers or plants or other things that appear in nature, and often tells of time passing and personal evolution through seasons changing, the weather, and other sort of environmental metaphors.
Now, Jess, you're a big fan of Dar Williams.
Yeah, I've been a fan for a while.
And you owe this interview, in fact, to a Hershey Kiss.
I do.
I think I should tell the story briefly. There was an expo at the New Humanism Conference where different organizations could hand out materials to people. I was walking through this corridor alone, and I passed Amanda Metzkis, who is the head of Camp Quest, and she shares our office building here in Albany, and she sort of flagged me over and said, "Duncan, this is Dar Williams." And it turns out that Dar was starving before her performance that night and saw a bowl of Hershey Kisses on Amanda's information table about Camp Quest and the book Parenting Beyond Belief. So, so we basically owe it all to Hershey Kisses. So I said, "Dar Williams, it's great to meet you. I have someone who would like to speak with you."
Yes.
And I grabbed Jess, and fortunately, you're the only person who got to interview her during this.
That's right. This is definitely an exclusive interview with Dar Williams from the whole conference.
Yeah, because afterwards, someone else wanted to interview her, and she said,
"Nope,
not give me
sorry.
That."
Yep.
Now, related to Amanda Metzkis at Camp Quest, Amanda is the wife of August Brunsman, and August mentioned in introducing Dar Williams that the first time he heard
The Christians and the Pagans, the song we just heard.
That he cried.
That's right.
Real men do cry.
And Dar, before she played that song, The Christians and the Pagans, she shared her inspiration for it, which was she had been studying religion at college and would come home on different breaks, and have dinner with her family. And each time she would come home and share with her family that she was now practicing a different religion. So, her parents are both very puzzled, but also, still very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
So she's had these religious experiences in her life, which she also wrote about in the next song that we're going to play for you called Teen for God. So in this song, she juxtaposes the danger of making yourself sort of this lightning rod, be it for the divine, for the dieting industry, or anything really for that matter, as a young teenager. And she puts that next to the ways that she benefited from being such a passionate teenager. So here's Dar explaining her inspiration for Teen for God.
So Teen for God, when I was a teenager, I was caught at the crossroads of the sort of passionate teenage religious experience, because teenagers can be very passionate about things that they're encountering for the first time as human beings, And then but that was also at the crossroads of that and sort of the way religion is used as a way of sort of keeping girls sort of just terrified of their own flowering. And I looked back on that with a friend of mine who went to a Christian camp, and she's Jewish. But we both loved it when we were there. We decided that though it was somewhat embarrassing to us at a certain point, it turned into sort of an interesting thing for us to have been such devoted Christians. And that it didn't harm us ultimately. So, ultimately I was going to make a song that ended up kind of badly. Like, here I am, a shell of a traumatized person for all of the crap that people put on top of my desire to be close to God, which is really what people often do, especially with teenagers, especially teenage girls. So, but then she and I decided neither of us were traumatized, and that we had a lot of love in our hearts for what a lot of the people were trying to do when they discovered that we were women of faith. And so it kind of has these two sides of it, of being very sort of cynical about the teenage religious experience and yet also very celebrating of it, and cynical now and kind of even missing what it was like to have such purism. So it was nice when the song played itself out. I really found that I had stepped into a lot of different territories of faith and non-faith.
Dear Lord, I plan each day the things I will not do or say, but I'm driven by a passion, is it only there to tame? Fills my heart and it calls my name. This world that you made for us, I know it's dangerous. So I ride a lot of horses, never even swear, sort of like pray, and I'm just not there. Oh God, God is watching. Oh God, God is watching. But God made love, God made the rivers run, and cowboy boots and bathing suits, and the boy's skin dries in the sun. You gotta help me, God. Help me know 4 years from now I won't believe in you anyhow, and I'm up around a campus and I'll feel betrayed. All those guilty summers I stay, but then I'll laugh that I fell for the lure of the pain of desire to feel so pure, and I'll bear all the burdens of my little daily crimes. Wish I had a God for such cynical times. Far from today, before now, I'm your sacred vessel. Rip me open, I spread your word like a milkweed cloud. I'm your radio station, your holy transmission. Even more like a lightning rod, I'm a lightning rod, a team for God, a team for God. God is a watching, team for God. God is a watching, I'm a team for God.
That was Dara Williams performing Teen for God from her album My Better Self, for which she won the Humanist Album of the Year award.
So, Jess, Dara told you that she, as a teenager, she had like the religion flavor of the week. What about now? Is she still religious or is she a humanist?
That was actually the first question that I asked her.
I was wondering if you could explain, you're getting this award for your album. And it's a humanist award, and I wonder if you actually described yourself as a humanist.
But why not? Well, what do I care about? I care about the environment. I care about arts outreach for kids. I care about women, but so many women care about women that actually I sort of stay away from that whole network, because I like to do things like organic rock salt, you know, benefits. And then... and then social justice issues, particularly for involving race, because I feel like that's where the much catching up has to happen. And you know, no peace without justice. So that addresses a certain spectrum. Actually, one of the things that's funny about being here is that Greg sort of pulled me aside and said, you know, we've come to understand that you believe in God. Well, that's okay. So, you know, I just woke up one morning and I believed in God. It happened about 8 years ago, and I've never affiliated with anything, but it's been in my life as a thing, you know, that with very little practice and with really no practice involved for 8 years. So that's an interesting sort of, it's kind of interesting to be in a world where I feel like, you know, it's not that I'm not religious enough. It's like, oh, well, that's not quite what our event is, but we'll take you.
So Dara Williams doesn't actively practice a religion, though she does believe in God.
So at the least, she's a humanist in practice, if not theory. Which, you know, is interesting because a lot of the people at this conference were referred to themselves as religious humanists, and then there was this other camp of secular humanists, and... I find it interesting, like, you know, the definitions of humanism, they generally say rejects supernaturalism, which would include God. But I met, you know, some people at the conference who were members of the American Humanist Association, who said they believed in God. So at the end of the day, though, these are metaphysical questions, metaphysical minutiae, and what really matters is our actions here on Earth, right, Jess?
Right, and kind of like how E.O. Wilson will say, let's just, you know, unite on what the things that we do sort of both believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And Dar Williams, when she's touring, she does this thing called the Echoes Initiative, which is what I asked her about last. And she sort of highlights communities where there's a grassroots, local, strong economy, you know, things like mass transit, community gardens, and you know, other very humanistic things.
Well, you know, the Echoes Initiative was this thing where we would do a little bit of fundraising and a little bit of consciousness raising around very local issues. You know, the more local, the more specific, the better. To celebrate that how this, you know, I don't want to sound condescending, but the small efforts had enormous ripple effects. And I felt like I, of all people, could speak to that because I would go back to cities year after year, and the cities that had some of that really tiny neighbor-to-neighbor infrastructure in place, or, you know, very municipally things like public transit systems, and really good public gardens and things like that, community gardens, were doing really well and starting to flourish more and more. And the cities that didn't have that, you'd see sprawl, you'd see alienation, you'd see big box stores. So it was a genuine connection and a genuine thumbs up on our part, just to give a little bit of attention to little groups. And out of that, I discovered that I was the most interested in the community gardens, because that was literally, you stick a seed in the ground and suddenly you take the garden in the direction that your community needs. For some, it's actually the food itself. For some, it's people understanding the importance of green space. For others, it's the job training of and the confidence building of at-risk teens. And, you know, every city took it in a different direction aesthetically and socially. And so in the future, I think I'm going to do something else that's not called the Echoes Initiative, call it something that's more direct. It's something that could be something much more like a garden party and to do something around that issue, because that's attached to everything.
Every time you love just a little, take one step closer, solving the riddle. It echoes all over the world. Every time you open to kindness, make one connection used to divide us. It echoes.
We're listening to Echoes, a track off of Dar Williams' album, My Better Self. We're playing the song with permission of Dar Williams. We're also going to take the show out with the rest of this song. You've been listening to the Humanist Network News podcast. To leave a comment about our show, please call our listener comment line at 206-339-4168.
To read transcripts and download previous episodes of the Humanist Network News podcast, visit humaniststudies.org/podcast. Or you can subscribe via iTunes, ihs.libsyn.com/RSS. To read our weekly Humanist Network News e-zine, visit humanistnetworknews.org.
Our theme music was generously donated by Holly Near. You can get more information at hollynear.com. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Warning, it echoes all over.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism. It echoes.